So, Bill, after you and Tom Nystrom left the Accents in late 1965, what did you do after that?
At that point, I joined another band. Tom got married, and Kenny Sands went to Vietnam.
Did you continue on in music?
I did.
What was the next band you played with?
There was a fellow in town named Dale Menton who had written some incredible music and still does to this day. He was in a band called The Gestures that had a record called Run, Run, Run that had actually climbed quite a ways up the charts. He, for different, I think, artistic reasons, decided to leave the band and pursue something a little bit larger. He actually bought the old K-Bank studio and transformed that into what was then called Cookhouse. There was a slot in that band open, and I filled that slot.
Okay, so you're in a new band. Is it a different experience as opposed to the Accents?
It was almost all touring, which was interesting because the band was based out of Mankato, and yet we pretty much lived in Indianapolis, or were based out of there through our booking agency and management. Really just drove all around the country doing different shows, auto shows, state fairs, yada, 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 personal appearances. The band unfortunately developed a bit of a reputation of, shall we say, not always appearing where we were supposed to be. And I ran across one of our posters that actually said, guaranteed performance. And I thought to myself, it's sort of like the George Jones story. It's like, really? Had we gotten to that point of undependability or unreliability? So, yeah, but it was a great couple of years that I spent in that band.
So after your time in The Gestures, what other bands did you play with?
Very interesting question. The word myriad crosses my mind because I had been fortunate enough to always work with great players, to put them together in different combinations to build a product I could actually market. And in that spirit, I probably put together 20 different bands over the next 10 years, some of them having a total run of 3 months, some lasting maybe a year. But again, it was a marketing thing. If I could market something and it was filling a need, then I could sell it. If I found I just sort of, for lack of a better word, ran out of juice and was much like our president, having to borrow from the Chinese, I pretty much bailed and started a new band. In the course of that, the number of band names that I experience are too voluminous to even go through. But some of them were quite popular. I remember a couple of sisters I worked with in a band called Special Blend, fiddle player and Donna. And that band went on to become Steamboat Willie and worked quite successfully here in town for a few years. I had two or three different versions of a group called Opal City Poker Chips. Again, worked either here in the Twin Cities or my final resurrection of that name encompassed two guys and a gal as a trio. And we spent some time working in Aspen. I want to go back to a group called Comfort Station. I think somewhere in the 70s, I met this guy, John Guerin, just an incredible humorist, great guitar player and good singer. And he and I sort of started a comedy duo, which later we added a pedal steel to. and became a trio. And the bulk of our career was spent working 2 weeks in Aspen, 2 weeks in Vail, 2 weeks in Steamboat Springs, and 2 weeks back in Minneapolis. But after 2 years, I was by then getting into my 30s, and they were somewhat younger than I was. And I just remember one day looking at them and going, guys, I just can't do this anymore. No. And about the time I was going to leave that group, I got a call from a friend of ours who would always come over from Vegas when we were in Vail and spend some time with us playing cards and eating food. And he said, Billy, there's a band I want you to get into if you're going to leave this one. And I said, well, tell me about it. His name was George Johnson, and he was a bass player. And he knew I was a bass player also. So there's a band I want you to look at.
Wait a minute. You were a bass player?
Well, in most of these bands, I was the piano player. But in Comfort Station, I played bass 50% of the time. It's all somewhat vague to me. But we were looking for a name that no one knew and that we thought would be appropriate for what we were bringing to the marketplace. And it was with a fellow named John Guerin. And he and I started that band as a duo, doing sort of a Smothers Brothers thing also, almost. It was a shtick thing with music. And later we brought a pedal steel into it and developed more into something like a mini version of Poco or the New Riders. But going back a step, in that band I played bass half the time and piano half the time. And we would just do the songs that were appropriate. We spent most of our time working 2 weeks in Aspen, 2 weeks in Vail, 2 weeks in Steamboat Springs, 2 weeks back in Minneapolis, 2 weeks back in Aspen, 2 weeks back in Vail. And after 2 years, I'd gotten to the point where it was like having multiple unsuccessful dates every 2 weeks. And I grew tired of it and said, guys, I'm, you know, 5-10 years older than both of you. I just want out. And a friend of ours who used to come see us all the time in Vail worked in Vegas with a show band there. And he said, Billy, if you're really going to leave, I want you to come to Vegas and audition for this band. And I said, what is it? And he said, well, I want you to come over and audition as a bass player. And I said, all right. He said, well, the rehearsals pay $500 a week, 2 to 4 weeks of rehearsals. And I said, all right. Well, who's the artist? Well, now, at that point in time, and remember, we're in the 70s here, there was a marginal set of artists who had unusual names or who were minorities. I recall Charlie Pride being perhaps the only successful black male artist in country music. And at that point in time, the offer was for country music. And I said, George, just tell me who the artist is. You've been jerking me around for 2 weeks here. Who's the artist? And he said, well, her name is Reba. And the very first image I got in my mind was pancake syrup. And I said, George, I'm not going to do it. I'm out of this. Take me out of the picture. And he said, no, Reba McEntire, this is going to be a great act. I took a pass on it. For about 3 years after that, every time George ran into me, he would just heckle the hell out of me because she went on to become Reba McEntire, of course. And I wound up working schlock bands in supper clubs or whatever I could find. And then 3 years later, her band all died in a very sad plane crash. And I called George and I just said, see, this is why I turned it down. I knew I'd be dead if I took your advice. that was for me kind of an interesting moment. But during the course of all of those experiences, which involved working out on Lake Minnetonka and getting a club owner to eat a frog, a live frog, for $50. I mean, I just had a great time playing music, doing shticks, and everything from duos to trios to four-piece to five-piece to six-piece. And somewhere in the course of all of that, from the accents, the drummer, Tommy Nystrom, came to me and said, there's this new movie out with John Travolta called Urban Cowboy. He said, it's got a mechanical bull in it. This movie is going to be a tremendous hit. And I have a guy who owns a club and wants to develop something along the lines of pursuing the hit he knows is coming. Thus came along a band called F Troop. We dressed in the outfits of the TV show. One guy, our fiddle player, banjo player, guitar player, took on the garb of the Indian. So we had three cavalry guys and one Indian. I got to tell you, the cavalry thing, our drummer was a very smart guy. He said, we're going to get spandex baseball pants, and we're going to look hot. The tall black boots, the spandex pants. This group's going to succeed. Much like feeling like somewhat of a B-class stripper, I discovered he was incredibly right. And it was really my introduction to accepting country music more stridently in terms of being a valid music form and something that I actually loved. So that was a great deal of fun. Sadly, over the next 6 or 7 years, that group mutated from being F Troop and dumping the uniforms and becoming the Troop and dumping the whole concept and becoming a group called RPM, because at that point in time, I don't know if it was the disco thing or the Bee Gees or something was changing. Anyway, I just sort of mutated following the marketplace and trying to figure out, how the heck can I sell my product? And what's the most money I can get for it?
Any other bands you recall, Bill?
One band that sticks out is a group called Livewire. We had just a phenomenal rise to success. The old story, overnight, and literally was overnight. I mean, within a period of 30 days, we went from a guy's living room rehearsals to making $1,500 a week split between four guys. I mean, we were all taking in $350-$400 a week. What we did was covers primarily, but we did exactly what was required at the time. Our house gig was at a place called Roberts Off 10, just north of 694 in Moundsview. And we were just astonished at the success. I mean, it came out of nowhere. The club was quite large, could probably seat easily 600-700 people. And we just hit. I mean, it was like looking at a girl across a room and she just connects with you. The crowd just connected with that band. The band was filled with great players who worked very hard at what they did. And we had tons of media support through, oddly enough, KDWB, because they had now sort of taken the spot of WDGY as being the hip station. And man, we just made money, played gigs, got tons of stuff that just fell in our lap. Shows and concerts, and it was a glorious couple of years. Oop. We just reveled in it, and of course spent all the money. it really was something in my life that I look back at. One of the few bands I actually have a video of where I look back at it and go, yeah.
Who were the band members in Livewire?
A guy named Roy Holdren was on drums. Great singer, great drummer. Ross, why can't I remember his last name? Passed away since. And a guy named Smurf on guitar and fiddle. And I actually can't remember his name either at this moment. But all great players and great guys. I mean, just a good band. Sadly, anytime you get together that number of really top drawer players, you also pull together that number of top drawer egos. And I thought I often wanted to release an album that would have the identical cover to the Eagles' first album, but change the lettering to the Egos and list all the people on the album cover that I have worked with that have been in one way or another insufferable or cheated me out of money or whatever the case might be. But I just thought it would be a hilarious album, even though I'd only be able to distribute it to a couple dozen people. But, you know, that's one of the things about the music business that I find so incredible. And perhaps this is true of any business endeavor. If you don't have a certain amount of ego and push, belief, faith, and resolve, you won't get there. I mean, certainly Steve Jobs, good example of a guy who actually got fired from Apple at one point in his career. But on the other hand, trying to find people who are creative and also contain all those other qualities that bring them sort of to the top of the coffee cup, it must be tempered with patience and a movie I'm just thinking about called Pay It Forward. I mean, there's so much in this industry that is ego-oriented, and there's so much in this industry, or any industry, that requires incredible cooperation and understanding, forgiveness, and the ability to just be a good human being. A footnote, an addendum to Recollections. F Troop, the group that wore the outfits and had the Indian and was actually quite successful for many years under different names. We played for quite a while, a year or two, at a wonderful club that used to be in Bloomington called the Carlton Backstage. Their whole shtick was a Vegas-style setting, and every night was a different, literally, Vegas act. First time I saw Emmy Lou, first time I saw Lee Greenwood, first time I saw any number of national artists, much less get to meet them. And we played what was the overflow room, or called the Carlton Backstage. And I was just incredibly lucky to be part of that experience. At that time, I carried a Yamaha Baby Grand piano. And on top of it, I had a fake campfire. And much like Johnny Carson used to use a dowel in his movie shtick where he was doing Art Fern. And he had Carol Wayne as the matinee lady. And he would crack the dowel down and go, "That's correct, matinee lady." And I just thought, what a great bit. And I began using that on the top of the piano alongside the campfire, which, because it was just an electric bulb plugged into it, would make it flicker. It got to the point where that became so much a part of the bit. And I was very lucky in my development of skills. I found that whatever I might have lacked as a performer, I was able to make up for in terms of being an entertainer. And that's always a hard thing to understand, I think, for a lot of up-and-coming musicians, is you can be terrific, but if you look like crap on stage, it's over. You can be somewhat mediocre, and if you look good, you will sell. And I was very lucky in both areas, in the sense that I worked very hard at performing, and I worked very hard at being a good musician.
Any other bands, Bill, that you recall?
Toward the end of my most active years, I was in a house band called Calvin James. And it was Jim Johnson from the Underbeats and Donnie Larson from the Underbeats. Both guys I'd known since the 60s. Terrific players. Terrific people. Although Donnie was a character, he was much like myself. He could be a little ostentatious. He could be a bit of a concern at times and had his own attitudes. But we had this blues band, and we had this Sunday gig over at Billy T's in St. Paul, and we were blessed by having these sax players that loved blues that would come over and see us and bring their axes. And we had Rick O'Dell, we had Jimmy Greenwell, and we had Bronco, who was just famous in town. And there would be times we'd have your basic four-piece blues band, but we'd have these three monster sax players. It was a horn section that I think Aykroyd and what's-his-name would have paid cash money for to do the Blues Brothers movie. I mean, these were the three premier sax players in town. And wow, it was better than the best pudding you've ever had. That was just a golden year or two in my life. As I've said earlier, I've just been very blessed. I've been able to work with quality players.
Okay. Bill, what's in the future for you? The rumor is you might be headed for Texas.
In 29 days, I will be 3 miles from the Mexican border. I will be eating tacos and enchiladas and huevos rancheros. And something I really would like to pursue now is Texas swing music, more along the lines of a Willie Nelson or a Bob Wills, finding new musicians in that part of the country, the Rio Grande, that are just so skilled in Texas music, Texas swing. I can't wait to get down there, because I know I'm going to be exposed to something new. And frankly, at my age, while it is concomitantly scary to me, it is also challenging and interesting. It's like meeting a new girl. You don't know what you're in for, but you have the opportunity to make an investment and find out, where am I going to go with this? What fruit do I think it will bring to bear? And how willing am I to be open-minded and learn new things? And my dad used to say to me, you know, Billy, God gave you 2 ears and one mouth. What do you think he had in mind? And I've always thought about that. A very interesting statement from my dad.
Bill, thank you for stopping by Sunrise Sound today and sharing with us your story about your time in the local music business.
Well, thank you for having me and cutting off all my comedic bits.
Can you just say thank you for having me?
I'm not sure I can do this.
Come on, just say.
No, wait a minute.
Just say thank you.
Is there a way?
No.
Now, you've gotten to know me well enough. Is there a way I can manipulate this?
Yes. Now that your finger's out of my prostate, we're moving along.
No, he is never going to allow that. Is there any way I can...
Say whatever you want.
There is... No, but he'll never let it go to print.
Well, it depends upon what you say.
Suggestions. Suggestion.
Be nice.
Thank you for having me over. I love you and Danny.
I got it.
Go ahead.
Tom, thank you very much. And one thing I hope people understand is the time, effort, expense that people like you take the interest level. Also, Denny Johnson, our recording engineer. There's a certain number of people who want to capture some of the crap from yesteryear. I perhaps could have chosen a different word. Or the memories. But no, the oddball thing is, it is so precious. And I use that word carefully. Precious, P-R-E-C-I-O-U-S. Precious to be remembered. And to have others take the interest, care, time, and expense to record this crap. Okay, bye.
Okay, stop. I'm not done yet. Ready? Well, on behalf of Danny Johnson and myself, thank you, Bill.